the space of years. Gaeta, in particular, preached this kind of police work, based on his belief that real-life human beings testifying before a jury, rather than colorless and boring documents, win convictions. Convincing people to talk, Gaeta felt, was his specialty, what made him an effective agent. He prided himself on being able to detect the vulnerabilities and motivations of sources on the insides of conspiracies, and then get them to agree to wear a wire and make clandestine recordings of criminal confessions. As a supervisor, Gaeta constantly pushed young agents to get out in the field in search of sources. But he also reminded them to be cautious. The goal was to get information, not to share it. Agents listen. Sources talk. Including eccentric British journalists. Sitting in Steele's office, the two agents and the Justice Department lawyer looked on expectantly as Jennings took a deep breath and gathered his thoughts. The story of modern soccer was really about the emergence of a new kind of business, one that turned out to have corruption baked into it nearly from the moment it was born. That business was built around the buying and selling of the rights to sponsor and broadcast events. This marketplace is so fundamental to the way all sporting activities are administered today that it almost escapes notice. But the idea of a brand like Adidas acquiring the exclusive right to plaster its logo at all FIFA events worldwide for years at a time and with one single contract was revolutionary a generation ago. The rapid growth of that new industry unlocked vast stores of value in events like the World Cup and Olympics, showering both those who ran the sports and those who marketed them with enormous sums of money. But it also proved susceptible, almost from the outset, to bribery and greed, leading directly to some of the most profound and intractable problems in sports. For FIFA, that story began some 35 years earlier, when the World Soccer Authority was a far smaller and simpler organization. That was where the story had to start, and there was a lot of ground to cover. By the time the Brazilian João Havelange was elected as FIFA's first non-European president, on July 11, 1974, FIFA still had fewer than 10 full-time employees. And, he later recalled, the general secretary, his wife, and their cat and dog lived in the same building. Meetings always had to be held somewhere else. Soccer, more than a century old by then, was still an unsophisticated enterprise. The tiny sums of money that it did generate came almost entirely from fans willing to buy tickets to sit in bare concrete bleachers and root for their teams. Player salaries were small, sponsorship non-existent, and the men who administered the sport were driven largely by a sense of public service and a love of the game. Havelange's predecessor, Sir Stanley Rouse, was a near-perfect embodiment of that romantic spirit. A tweedy Englishman who seemed allergic to the sport's commercial possibilities, he largely occupied himself with preserving increasingly rusty notions of amateurism that seemed Victorian, if not downright colonialist, to FIFA's fast-growing international membership. Havelange, a lawyer and businessman, was a distinctly different animal. He liked to tell the story of how FIFA had little more than $30 in its bank account when he took over. FIFA, he would say, had no money, not a cent. He exaggerated. The non-profit organization, in fact, had revenue of about $25 million in 1974, mostly from the World Cup. But it was clear that the sport's supreme body came up far short in terms of maximizing its revenue potential. Havelange had built his campaign platform around an 8-point pledge to change the game, focused largely on assistance to the developing nations that voted him into office, as well as a promise to expand the number of teams playing in the World Cup so that more countries would have a chance to reap its substantial financial benefits. But accomplishing all that would cost considerable sums of money that FIFA simply did not have. Help came in the person of Horst Dassler, the scion of the family that founded Adidas, and young British advertising man Patrick Nally. Their vision was to bring in large corporate brands that would pump cash into soccer in exchange for a complete and exclusive sponsorship deal that would last for years and would include the World Cup and all other FIFA events. Until then, advertisers simply paid money to stadium owners to rent space where they could plaster their logos on a game-by-game or seasonal basis. Little, if any, of that money went to teams, leagues, or FIFA itself. What Dassler and Nally recognized was that FIFA and all the soccer organizations beneath it were the entities with the valuable asset, not the stadium owners, and that asset was soccer. Soccer was why people went to the stadium. Soccer was the golden goose. As a result, Dassler and Nally figured, soccer organizations could assert for the first time the right to control all advertising and sponsorship related to matches. Once that was done, the rights could be bundled into huge, all-inclusive rights packages worth millions of dollars that guaranteed brands exclusivity and uniformity. Dassler and Nally would place themselves in the middle of those transactions, creating a new kind of business that came to be called a sports marketing firm, which would buy the commercial rights to FIFA events wholesale and then resell them piecemeal, with a rich margin built into the price. The model they invented would soon become ubiquitous in sports. But in the mid-1970s, it seemed revolutionary, if not downright crazy, and it took the two men more than 18 months of aggressive salesmanship to convince Coca-Cola to commit at least $8 million to become FIFA's first brand partner and the first exclusive worldwide sponsor in the history of sports. It was a watershed moment. The FIFA Coca-Cola World Football Development Program that Dassler and Nally created marked the beginning of a new kind of symbiotic relationship, directly between international brands and sports organizations, which started providing most of their revenue. Coca-Cola's cash allowed Avalanche to deliver on his pledges, increasing the size of the World Cup, allotting more guaranteed berths to teams from Africa, Asia, and Oceania, the region incorporating New Zealand and the South Pacific, and continually nurturing relationships with politically influential officials through direct patronage. First, he gave away equipment, coaching, and medical training, mostly through the Coca-Cola program, to impoverished federations. Later, when FIFA's revenue began soaring, the support took the form of either development grants or loans that came with few strings attached, and vanishingly little oversight. Avalanche would provide for all of FIFA's member associations, and they, dutifully, would re-elect him every 4 years. It was, simply put, cash for votes. The growing dependence on multinational sponsors meant that the fundamental mission, image, and activities of FIFA, the IOC, and similar organizations would be increasingly determined by the profit-seeking motives of huge multinational corporations. And the explosion in value of television rights, starting a few years later as global transmission technology improved, would only push things further in that direction. Dassler and Nally, meanwhile, saw in the Coca-Cola deal the foundation of a new commercial era, with giant companies paying ever-increasing sums for rights, and specialized sports marketing at the center of everything, controlling all aspects of deals, speaking for both sides, and of course taking their considerable cut of everything. The key to success in the emerging industry was gaining control of the rights, at any cost. Over the decades, Coca-Cola would pump hundreds of millions of dollars into FIFA in one of the longest-lasting branding partnerships in all of sports. But when it first signed the deal, marketing executives at the Atlanta soft drink giant saw it as a significant risk and insisted that Dassler and Nally find someone who could protect its interests within FIFA. The ideal candidate, everyone agreed, would be someone Swiss, with experience in public relations and administration. A loyal person who understood sports as primarily a commercial activity. Someone who would travel the world promoting soccer and fizzy, caramel-colored beverages, while handing out free uniforms, balls, and cleats to Avalanche's electoral base, starting with a trip to Ethiopia on November 17, 1976. That someone was Sepp Blatter, FIFA's first development officer and future president. Joseph Blatter, son of a bicycle mechanic and factory worker, was born in March 1936, 2 months premature, too young to even have nails on his fingertips. Without a neonatal ward in the local hospital, his mother, Bertha, was forced to care for him in the family house in the Swiss town of Visp. Bertha doted on him, calling her son Chéri. Everyone else just used the common diminutive for Joseph, Sepp. Visp is in the canton of Valais, in the south of Switzerland, home to the jagged, imposing Matterhorn, and the area's verdant green hills are dotted with small dairy farms and vineyards. It is not a wealthy region, and the locals pride themselves on their toughness, independence, simplicity, and deep sense of loyalty. Other Swiss view natives with suspicion, as insular, guarded, and even downright unfriendly. If you have a friend visiting you from far away, that is what hotels are for, Blatter's father was fond of saying. If he needs a ride, that is what taxis are for. And if he is hungry, that is what restaurants are for. As a child, Blatter was drawn to athletic endeavors, and he particularly loved ice hockey, hugely popular in the German-speaking regions of Switzerland. But a small stature made a sporting future highly unlikely. Instead, he turned to the business behind the games. By the time he took the development job at FIFA, Blatter, age 39, had spent 4 years in the Swiss Army, earned degrees in economics and public relations, worked for the Valais Tourism Board, the Swiss Ice Hockey Federation, and finally for watchmaker Longines, where he ran its Olympic timing division. Avalanche promoted Blatter to General Secretary of FIFA in 1981, in significant part because he had developed an excellent working relationship with Dassler. The Adidas man had rapidly expanded his budding business into other sports organizations, including the Olympics. But FIFA and the World Cup were its bread and butter. As General Secretary, Blatter played an integral role in a period of significant economic growth for FIFA, overseeing World Cups in Spain, Mexico, Italy, and the U.S. in 1994. By the time soccer's premier event reached the shores of America, Blatter had been in the position for 13 years, and his ambitions were now fixated on FIFA's highest throne. After an aborted attempt to campaign against Avalanche in 1994, Blatter was finally given the Brazilians' blessings when the older man decided to retire after 24 years as FIFA president. He was elected in Paris on the eve of the 1998 World Cup in France, defeating the head of the European Soccer Confederation, known as UEFA. The election was marred with accusations of foul play, as Blatter had been the underdog and was expected to lose by at least 20 votes. Among Blatter's most enthusiastic supporters had been Jack Warner, who wrangled CONCACAF's votes in his favor, and a fabulously wealthy Qatari construction magnate named Mohammed bin Hammam, who also sat on the Exco. 4 years later, the president of the Somali Football Federation would claim he had been offered $100,000, half of it in cash, to vote for Blatter, and that 18 African voters accepted bribes to vote for Blatter, enough to swing the election. The financial inducements, the Somali alleged, were handed out the night before the election in the Tony Le Meridien Hotel, where Blatter was staying. People were lining up, he said, to receive money. Blatter and bin Hammam sued the Somali for libel, then dragged him before the FIFA Disciplinary Committee, where he was banned from the sport for 2 years for failing to provide enough evidence to support his accusations. The allegations, FIFA said in a terse statement, undermined the interests of football as a whole, and were soon forgotten. The biggest blow to Blatter's young presidency, one that would haunt the entire organization for years and foreshadow later crises, came on May 21, 2001, when FIFA's main commercial partner, International Sport and Leisure, or ISL, declared bankruptcy in the Swiss canton of Zug. ISL had been founded by Horst Dassler in the early 1980s after breaking with Nally. It continued with the same business model, adding television rights to the advertising packages it bought up en masse from FIFA, and soon expanding to buy rights to the Olympics as well. Although Dassler died of cancer in 1987, ISL still maintained control of most of FIFA's commercial activities, and in 1996 pledged to pay the soccer body $1.6 billion for the television and marketing rights to the 2002 and 2006 World Cups. But ISL had run out of cash after overextending itself on numerous other sports rights deals, and after futile attempts to sell itself, was pushed into liquidation. Without its longtime marketing partner, FIFA faced the prospect of crippling losses, and was forced to negotiate a cascading series of economic and logistical headaches in order to ensure that broadcast and advertising rights to the 2002 World Cup in South Korea and Japan were properly sold and managed. Scarcely a week after the bankruptcy filing, FIFA filed a criminal complaint against ISL's executives, charging them with suspicion of fraud, embezzlement, and disloyal business management, and arguing that the defunct firm had purposely withheld a $60 million payment it owed FIFA for sale of World Cup television rights. Despite mounting criticism and accusations of bribery, fraud, and corruption, Blatter was re-elected the following year, and in 2004, FIFA quietly withdrew its criminal complaint against ISL, apparently consigning the marketing firm to oblivion. But a prosecutor in the obscure Swiss canton of Zug, named Thomas Hildebrand, continued digging into the matter, tirelessly poring over bank records from around the world, as well as documents seized in a raid of FIFA headquarters in 2005, Hildebrand began to assemble a mammoth case alleging that ISL had paid millions of dollars in bribes and kickbacks to sports officials in exchange for the television and marketing rights contracts that were its lifeblood. Eventually, Hildebrand's probe uncovered evidence that between 1989 and 2001, at least $22 million in illicit payments were wired through a complicated series of offshore companies to accounts controlled by João Havelange and his son-in-law, Ricardo Teixeira, who was president of Brazil's Soccer Association. Considerable sums were also paid to Nicolas Lios, president of the South American Confederation, known as CONMEBOL. Yet commercial bribery at the time was not a crime in Switzerland. Not one of those FIFA officials was ever charged, and their identities were kept a secret from the public. Hildebrand did eventually bring charges against six ISL executives. But in 2008, judges hearing the case acquitted most of them, with three forced to pay only modest fines. None ever went to prison. Far from denying the corruption allegations against them, the ISL executives freely admitted during trial that bribes had been paid. One of them, who had been chief executive of the firm when it collapsed, explained in court that ISL and rival marketing companies had been paying sports officials bribes, he called them commissions, for decades, to ensure they'd maintain control over lucrative marketing and television rights contracts. Indeed, Dassler had confided to Nally as far back as 1978 that he intended to bribe Havelange. Once Havelange started taking money under the table, he belonged to Dassler. The FIFA president would not cede rights to anyone else. It was the birth of modern sports bribery. From there, Dassler began paying off more and more officials until it became the defining feature of ISL's business. The appeal of such payments was that they guaranteed there wouldn't ever be any competition for rights, keeping the price low. In exchange for under-the-table cash, sports officials would sign over their rights for prices far below market value, often for years or even decades at a time, and would reject any outside offers. That created the opportunity for huge profits for the bribe-paying sports marketing firms and secret fortunes for the bribe-receiving sports officials. But it also effectively robbed the sport of money it would have received had the rights been sold in a truly open and competitive market. Sports officials, meanwhile, who had once sought leadership positions out of an abiding love for the game, came to view them as viable financial opportunities. They began to insist on bribes and refused to sign rights contracts without them. The company would not have existed if it had not made such payments, the disgraced ISL executive said. All of international sports, he was trying to explain to the black-robed judges, was propped up by corruption. As it turned out, very few people were listening at the time. With all his breathless talk of corruption and secret payouts behind closed doors, Jennings certainly had Gaeta's attention. The two men had the same instincts when it came to crime, as well as a shared gut feeling that everyone on some level was on the take. Jennings' tale of FIFA corruption was complicated and dense, but also packed with what seemed like significant leads to chase. And what Jennings had outlined in that first meeting was just the beginning. Gaeta could see that FIFA's tendrils reached across a vast of territory and a huge cast of characters. There were, for example, the photographs Jennings had published of Blatter in 2005, enjoying a cocktail at a Moscow nightclub with Taiwanchik, the Russian Gaeta's squad already believed was a major crime boss. If the FBI could somehow tie corruption within FIFA to the Russian mob, well, that would tick off just about every box. Gaeta knew he could learn a lot from a man like Jennings, who seemed to have an answer, and a rollicking anecdote, to every question. He and the others quizzed him on every soccer figure they could think of, and when they'd finally had enough for the day, they gave the journalist their business cards, which bore the FBI seal embossed in gold leaf, along with their titles, email addresses, and cell phone numbers. They would take all this information back to New York and try to figure out if there was a case that could be made. Soon enough, they'd be talking to him again. Chapter 4. A Guy from Queens. On August 5th, 2010, CONCACAF General Secretary Chuck Blazer, in a dark blue suit, white shirt, suspenders, and a gaudy pink, black, and gray floral tie, was escorted into the Russian White House on the banks of the Moskva River for what he called a very special occasion. The Soviet-era building with its white marble facade and polished marble floors is the seat of government for the Russian Federation and serves as the office of its prime minister. Accompanied by a translator, Blazer was escorted by a raft of cabinet ministers into the office of Vladimir Putin. Grinning, Blazer clasped Putin's hand, then took a seat beside fellow EXCO member Vitaly Mutko. "You know," Putin said, "you look just like Karl Marx." Blazer, 65 years old and with a massive belly pressed against the coffee table, winked and said, "I know." Putin raised his hand and gave the American a high five. As prime minister of a country of 150 million people, Putin was a busy man. That very morning, he had been frantically attempting to manage a disastrous string of forest fires that had broken out across the country. But with the competition to win the World Cup bid in full swing, Putin seemed to have nothing but time on his hands for the EXCO member. He had ensured that Blazer had been treated solicitously during his stay in Moscow. And now, in his office, he made sure to ask about Blazer's pet project, a travel blog he'd started during the 2006 World Cup in Germany. The blog, which had started as Inside the World Cup and then became Travels with Chuck Blazer, was stuffed with pictures of Blazer in the company of friends, soccer officials, sports marketers, and the more than occasional beauty pageant contestant. Bright and cheerful, it provided a glimpse into the profoundly luxurious life Blazer and other EXCO members led. The blog was largely populated with snapshots of soccer events around the world, and had little in the way of commentary or analysis because, Blazer noted, recreational writing at times can be very demanding in the face of other obligations. Many of the posts showed Blazer out to dinner with friends from the world of sports, visiting museums or commemorating holidays. Fond of wearing costumes for special occasions, one post showed him dressed up as a pirate, while another had him elaborately frocked as Obi-Wan Kenobi from Star Wars, taking his grandchildren out for Halloween trick-or-treating. Putin listened intently as Blazer told him in great detail about the blog and its origins. The Russian leader peered fixedly into his eyes, then casually mentioned that he'd be taking a long trip into the Russian countryside at the end of summer. "If I sent you pictures from my trip," he asked, "will you post them in your blog?" Blazer, flattered, quickly agreed, pledging not only to post the photos, but also that he'd rename his blog Travels with Chuck Blazer and His Friends, to commemorate his newly struck friendship with Vladimir Putin, one of the world's most feared and powerful men. The Youth Soccer Association of New Rochelle, New York, where Charles Gordon Blazer got his start in the game in the mid-1970s, was run by volunteers, mostly business executives and lawyers, who saw the sport as a wholesome pastime for their children and who promoted it with almost religious fervor. The mission of the league, founded in 1973, was to ensure the growth of children through what we believe to be a healthy and challenging sport. Long ignored to the point of irrelevance in America, soccer had in less than a decade found significant purchase among middle-class suburban families eager to embrace an outdoor sport other than baseball and tackle football for their children to play. That spurt coincided with the birth of the North American Soccer League, or NASL, a glitzy professional association which, thanks to an influx of marketable stars like Pelé, brought the sport mainstream U.S. attention for the first time. Around the country, parents of little children were suddenly willing to fork over $50, $100, or more every year for their children to play this odd game where you can't use your hands and nobody ever seemed to score. Most of the men and women involved in the New Rochelle League were working parents who didn't have the time to take on the complexities of managing a fast-growing soccer organization. The league's founder ran a textile mill, and its first president was an insurance executive who worked long hours in Manhattan. They viewed the league as a simple way to do something for their kids. Blazer, on the other hand, developed a very different and, in some ways, visionary perspective on the game. He recognized tremendous untapped financial opportunity for himself in soccer, a sport with almost zero commercial viability in the U.S. at the time. Born in 1945 and raised in Flushing, Queens, Blazer had never played the sport. A strong student, he got a degree in accounting from NYU, started coursework for an MBA, but then dropped out to get into sales, eventually hawking promotional items like T-shirts and frisbees. His daughter, Marcy, was born in 1968, and his son, Jason, came 2 years later, and by the time they were old enough to join the New Rochelle League, Blazer had plenty of free time on his hands. Within a few years of seeing his first ever soccer match, Blazer became a director of the New Rochelle League, co-founded the Westchester Youth Soccer League, and in 1980 was elected first vice president of the Southern New York Youth Soccer Association, which oversaw the sport across a large swath of the state. In 1984, he took a big leap, winning the vote for executive vice president of the United States Soccer Federation, which oversaw all soccer in the country. The federation, housed on the 40th floor of the Empire State Building, was flat broke, having run a $600,000 deficit in the prior year, and Blazer's position was unpaid. For Blazer, however, it was a turning point, the moment his ideas about a career in global soccer, an almost preposterous idea for an American at the time, began to seem possible. Traveling extensively, Blazer oversaw the struggling national team, which hadn't qualified for a World Cup since 1950, as well as the committee that sanctioned international matches playing in the U.S., a key source of revenue for the federation. In those roles, Blazer began to see the workings of the sport's financial side, still rudimentary and underdeveloped, and recognized the potential lurking beyond the field of play. "There's no magic," Blazer, assuming the tone of a business executive, told a reporter shortly after taking the job. "To erase the deficit, we have to have a viable, saleable product that attracts sponsors." But the product did not prove saleable. The glitzy North American Soccer League, wilting after its late 1970s heyday, played its final match in October 1984. FIFA had rejected America's bid to host the 1986 World Cup in favor of Mexico, and the U.S. national team was eliminated from qualifying for that tournament in May 1985 before a home crowd in Torrance, California, that seemed far more interested in rooting for its opponent, Costa Rica. In July 1986, just days after he returned from the Mexico World Cup, Blazer lost his bid for a second term to a Louisiana lawyer who campaigned on the promise to focus on youth soccer rather than the international side of the game. But Blazer, by then fully committed to a career in soccer, quickly bounced back. And in early 1987, he and a British expat co-founded the American Soccer League, a low-budget alternative to the NASL, which folded after the 1984 season. As commissioner of the upstart new league, Blazer paid himself a $48,000 salary and ran operations out of his house in Scarsdale. "We intend to appeal to the suburban soccer family," he said. The league played its first match in April 1988, but by year's end, Blazer had been run out of the commissioner's job by owners furious that he refused to share information about finances with them, was unwilling to delegate, and appeared to be abusing his expense account. Undeterred, he immediately landed a job as president of one of the league's franchises, the Miami Sharks, where Blazer set his own salary at $72,000, despite the fact that the team drew fewer than 1,000 spectators per game. In May 1989, Blazer was fired by the team's Brazilian owner. Less than a year later, however, he pulled off his greatest coup, masterminding the campaign of Trinidad's Jack Warner for the CONCACAF presidency, and serving as his campaign manager. In April 1990, Warner upset a longtime incumbent from Mexico, and soon after rewarded Blazer by making him the Confederation's general secretary. While Warner occupied himself with the game's political side, Blazer went about figuring out how to make CONCACAF money. When he and Warner took over, the organization, founded in the early 1960s, had a budget of $140,000, just $57,000 in the bank, and its main office in Guatemala City. Blazer moved CONCACAF's headquarters to New York, and within a few months, Donald Trump personally offered him offices taking up the 17th floor of Trump Tower. With the economy in recession and occupancy rates low, the real estate magnate proposed giving Blazer a year's rent for free and 11 additional years at half the market rate. Blazer, who came to consider Trump a close friend, called the deal evidence of some spiritual force looking after us. He soon created the Gold Cup, a tournament that pitted the Confederation's national teams against one another in a format similar to the World Cup. Launched as a showpiece focusing on the U.S. and Mexican national teams, the Gold Cup soon would bring in tens of millions of dollars in television and sponsorship money every time it was played. In early 1997, a seat on the FIFA Exco opened when one of CONCACAF's three representatives died of a sudden heart attack. Although others had expressed an interest in the open seat, none was given a real chance. Warner, in a typically dictatorial move, allowed no campaigning, insisted on a vote via fax, and announced that Blazer had been elected to soccer's most powerful board 3 days later. Over time, Blazer would come to sit on five FIFA committees, including the Exco. On his watch, soccer in North America went from obscurity to a viable enterprise, with income cascading in from sponsorships, advertising, and television deals. Blazer not only helped FIFA through the catastrophic collapse of its outside marketing and television partner, ISL, but he was instrumental in steering it to far greater revenue down the road. CONCACAF, meanwhile, saw its receipts grow from nearly zero in 1990 to $35 million in 2009, while its prestige and influence within FIFA skyrocketed. The United States Professional Soccer League, Major League Soccer, which did not even exist when Blazer joined CONCACAF, won a long-term contract with ESPN, thanks largely to Blazer's direct influence. Women's soccer, which he championed while at the U.S. Soccer Federation, played its first World Cup on Blazer's watch, and the tournament had twice been held in the U.S. since then. Divorced, Blazer lived with his girlfriend, an attractive former soap opera actress, in a roomy luxury apartment on the 49th floor of Trump Tower. He had a $900,000 beachside condo in the Bahamas, and arranged for the purchase of adjacent apartments with views of Biscayne Bay high above Miami's South Beach for his exclusive use. As it did for all two dozen Exco members, FIFA paid for Blazer to travel first class to its numerous events and meetings around the world, showering him with five-star luxury accommodations, chauffeured limousines, gourmet meals, fine wine, gifts, and a seemingly endless supply of match tickets. It paid him an annual stipend of $100,000, not including additional travel expenses, a yearly bonus of at least $75,000, and a generous per diem in cash whenever he was on the road. He socialized with presidents, royalty, and billionaires, counted celebrities and successful television producers as friends, spent nights carousing at legendary New York hotspot Elaine's, and even won the occasional personal favor from his good pal Donald Trump, who, for example, once allowed Blazer to host his high school reunion in Trump Tower's glittering lobby. Famous among soccer fans outside the U.S. for his massive size and bushy white beard, he enjoyed almost total anonymity at home, and could freely make trips around Central Park on his mobility scooter, his pet parrot perched on his shoulder, without fear of being bothered by soccer fans or members of the sporting press. It was, in sum, a rather impressive and altogether unexpected lifestyle for an overweight guy from Queens who never so much as kicked a soccer ball until he was more than 30 years old. On August 23, 2010, soon after returning from Moscow, Blazer received an email from his old friend Jack Warner. The two men were different in seemingly every way. Where Blazer, the stereotypical New Yorker, was loud and gregarious, Warner, from the Trinidadian countryside, was quiet and reserved. Boisterous and sociable, Blazer loved a big spectacle, and particularly drawing attention to himself. Warner, who suffered from a mild speech impediment that made his already thick Caribbean accent nearly impenetrable, tended to prefer intimate dinners. He insisted on elaborate, formal shows of respect, and his anger over perceived slights could simmer for years. Blazer's domain was Manhattan, while Warner lived in the suburbs of Trinidad's capital, Port of Spain. Still, they often made international trips together, attended official events in each other's company, and presided in tandem over an endless series of CONCACAF meetings. And despite their differences, the unlikely pair complemented each other and grew close, even taking family vacations together on occasion. Thanks to his position as a FIFA vice president and president of CONCACAF, Warner was far better known in the soccer world than Blazer, the focus of constant attention in the sporting press. But those who followed soccer closely viewed the pair as inseparable. Jack and Chuck, everyone called them. The August email from Warner was brief, advising the General Secretary that he would soon receive a payment he had been inquiring about, with increasing urgency for some time. The money was part of a $10 million sum South Africa had secretly pledged to Warner more than 6 years earlier. At the time, South Africa was bidding to host the 2010 World Cup, and had been competing against Morocco and Egypt for the honor. Ostensibly, the money was sent to support the African diaspora in Caribbean countries as part of the World Cup legacy, but nobody had illusions about what it was. A bribe for favorable votes. And indeed, when the Exco met in Zurich in May 2004 to decide who would host the tournament, Warner and Blazer dutifully cast their ballots in South Africa's favor. Their votes proved decisive. By a 14-10 margin, South Africa had won the right to host the 2010 World Cup. Warner promised Blazer that when the money arrived, $1 million of it would be his. "I'm proud of my vote for South Africa and proud of FIFA," Blazer told a reporter a few days later from his apartment high above Manhattan. But as time passed, Blazer realized he had never seen a dime. He occasionally asked Warner about it, but never managed to get a straight answer. It seemed, he slowly gathered, that the South Africans had run into difficulties in finding a way to make the payment, and Warner had eventually turned to FIFA's General Secretary to intercede on his behalf. After a long and heated negotiation, a total of $10 million, in three payments, was wired by FIFA in early 2008 to accounts that were registered under the names of CONCACAF and the Caribbean Football Union, but were in fact controlled solely by Jack Warner. That December, Warner finally gave Blazer part of what he was owed, wiring $298,500 to an account he held in a Cayman Islands bank. It was aggravating, and yet typical of how things had evolved between the two old friends. Blazer's vote on the FIFA Exco counted exactly as much as Warner's, yet he was forced to beg for full payment of his meager slice of the big pot. The email Warner sent to Blazer then came as a relief. Hopefully this unpleasant remnant of old business could at last be put to rest. On September 23rd, a check for $205,000, drawing from the Caribbean Football Union account at a Republic Bank branch in Port of Spain, was drafted and then sent to Blazer. It was made out to a company he controlled, Sportvertising Inc., which was registered in the Cayman Islands. It wasn't the full $701,500 Warner still owed him for his purchased vote, but at least it was a start. 4 days later, Blazer deposited the check into an account he used for day trading stocks at Merrill Lynch. The brokerage had an office on Fifth Avenue less than a block away from Trump Tower, and taking the check there was certainly much less hassle than mailing it to his bank in the Caymans. "For deposit only," Blazer wrote on the reverse. The minor convenience would come at a very high price. Chapter 5. The Vote. A thin crust of icy snow coated the grounds of FIFA's Zurich headquarters early on December 2, 2010, as members of the executive committee arrived to cast perhaps the most important votes in soccer history. Without stopping, they glided past security in black chauffeur-driven Mercedes S-Class sedans, then down a long ramp leading directly into the bowels of the building. There, they alighted on the third subfloor without ever having to step outside or be observed by the crowds of journalists who had been gathering since before dawn at the building's entrance. The building, known in soccer circles as FIFA House, was an imposing symbol of what the once humble sports governing body had become. Designed by a noted Swiss architect and built for $200 million, the building, opened in 2007, presented a cold, inscrutable facade of shiny glass covered by steel mesh, set so far back from perimeter fences and guard posts that it could not be seen from the street. It stood in remarkable contrast to FIFA's first Zurich home, a shabby two-room suite that it rented above the city's busiest avenue for more than 20 years. The new headquarters stood on a secluded 11-acre lot high above the city. The expansive property boasted a full-sized soccer pitch, several smaller playing fields, and a fitness center, as well as six carefully maintained gardens stocked with exotic plants imported from around the globe at great expense. Each represented one of the different regional confederations governing world soccer. A lush rainforest made of Pacific Northwest pines, ferns, and mosses stood in for CONCACAF, for example. Sometimes called an underground skyscraper, five of FIFA House's eight floors were subterranean, and the building's grand lobby, redolent in contrasting polished and rough-hewn stone, was quietly decorated with expensively discreet flowers. Access was tightly controlled, and doors throughout the building could be opened only with high-tech fingerprint sensors, giving visitors the distinct impression of being in a clandestine military installation. Or a bank vault. The aesthetic was rigorously Swiss, with almost no adornment anywhere, but it was clear that no expense had been spared. Even the elevators with see-through glass doors were fitted with strangely entrancing glowing lights on the outside of their carriages. The lights served no obvious purpose, but seemed to whisper softly yet confidently that money had been spent here. The beating heart of both building and institution was found on the third sublevel. There sat the executive boardroom, where FIFA's exco made soccer's most critical decisions. It was a room within a room, a dark, impenetrable war chamber ripped from some Cold War political drama, with tall, curved walls sheathed in hammered aluminum and floors of polished lapis lazuli. Black-stained oak desks were arrayed in a large square beneath a massive crystal chandelier in the oval form of a stadium bowl. No sunlight was allowed to penetrate the enclosure, Blatter explained on occasion, of the building's opening, because places where people make decisions should contain only indirect light. Nearby was a suite of immaculate, spacious bathrooms reserved for FIFA executives, and beyond them an achingly beautiful and staggeringly expensive glowing meditation chamber made entirely of onyx slabs illuminated from within. The room, created in deference to Muslim members of FIFA's executive committee, contained two simple benches and a prayer rug, with a green arrow in the door jamb pointing in the direction of Mecca. Finally, at the far end of the floor, there was a lounge furnished with modern upholstered sofas and armchairs, where, between meetings, ex-co members were served refreshments beneath a crepe chandelier. Hanging on the wall at one end of the lounge was one of the only works of art visible anywhere within FIFA headquarters. A neon installation in curving script by the Italian artist Mario Merz. It posed an intriguing question.
Noi giriamo intorno alle case o le case girano intorno a noi?
Do we revolve around the house, or does the house revolve around us? At the turn of the 20th century, the soaring popularity of the relatively new sport of soccer led to demand for organizing matches between clubs hailing from different nations. But the way the sport was played varied enormously from place to place, and the need for a single organizing body that could ensure fair matches between countries grew increasingly apparent. Britain's four soccer associations, which viewed themselves as the sport's inventors and greatest practitioners, were uninterested in submitting to a higher authority. England's Football Association, already 40 years old, was particularly skeptical, writing dourly that it cannot see the advantages of such a federation, and refusing to have anything further to do with it. Undaunted, seven continental groups representing France, Belgium, Denmark, the Netherlands, Spain, Sweden, and Switzerland met in the back room of a Parisian sports club on May 21, 1904, and decided to organize without the Brits. They called their non-profit organization the Fédération Internationale de Football Association, and by joining, the pioneering officials pledged to adhere exclusively to its statutes, giving it supreme authority over the sport. Everyone was to play the game by the same set of rules on the pitch. Perhaps most importantly, FIFA would demand absolute allegiance from its members, and the complete exclusion of any soccer associations that did not prove to be faithful members of the club. Within a few months, Germany agreed to pay the annual membership fee of 50 French francs, and eventually England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland joined as well. South Africa became the first non-European member, affiliating in 1909. Argentina and Chile joined in 1912, and the United States entered the fold the following year. In 1928, under pressure from its members to create a tournament that would rival the popularity of soccer at the Olympics, while also admitting professional players, which the International Olympic Committee did not, FIFA announced plans for the first World Cup. Five countries submitted bids to host. But Uruguay's Soccer Association, which had won gold medals in the 1924 and 1928 Olympics, offered to cover the travel costs of visiting teams, to build a huge new stadium at its own expense, and to share any profits with FIFA while absorbing all the risk of a financial loss by itself. These arguments, FIFA later noted, were decisive. Unwilling or unable to make such financial commitments, the other countries dropped their bids and 13 nations ultimately competed in the first World Cup, which was an instant hit. On July 30, 1930, 70,000 fans filled Montevideo's brand new Estadio Centenario to watch Uruguay defeat Argentina 4-2 in the final. The event's surging popularity did not, however, net substantial financial gains for many years. For its first several decades, FIFA largely persisted thanks to annual fees paid by its members, plus small commissions it charged on ticket sales at international matches. It gave away, free of charge, the broadcast rights to its first televised World Cup, held in Switzerland in 1954, and even at the 1974 World Cup in West Germany, the majority of tournament revenue still came from ticket sales. That rapidly changed with the advent of modern communications and advertising. And soon, television and sponsorship deals far outstripped gate income. Because such a large share of FIFA's revenue began to derive from the World Cup, the non-profit opted to measure its finances in four-year cycles, concluding with the championship tournament. The cycle ending with the 1974 World Cup netted a tidy profit of just under $20 million. For the 2007 to 2010 period culminating in South Africa, FIFA booked a record profit of $631 million, and FIFA's cash reserves reached $1.3 billion. The World Cup had become the largest and most lucrative sporting event in human history. When in Zurich, FIFA Exco members stayed at the Bar Alok, a 165-year-old monument to the very Swiss aesthetic of expensive understatement. The hotel, close on the banks of Lake Zurich, prides itself on absolute discretion, but does admit to having put up, among others, Haile Selassie, Austrian Empress Elizabeth, and Kaiser Wilhelm II. During FIFA meetings, the men controlling world soccer could often be found sprawled on overstuffed couches in the Bauer Alok's lounge, in suits, thobs, and robes, gossiping about the sport's recondite politics over pricey cocktails and elaborate tea services on silver trays. Just weeks before the December 2010 World Cup vote, two Exco members, Nigerian Amos Adamu and Tahitian Reynald Tamari, had been suspended by FIFA's ethics committee following an undercover sting operation by the Times of London that caught them on tape offering to sell their votes in exchange for six- and seven-figure bribes. Blatter called it a sad day for football. the committee's remaining 22 constituents were a colorful, if motley, group that included a number of former professional soccer players, a medical doctor, a hardware store owner, executives of airlines and oil companies, a champion middle-distance runner, several professional politicians, a handful of lawyers, and at least two billionaires. On the eve of the vote, December 1st, the nine nations making World Cup bids had staked out the Bauer Alok to make one last lobbying push, bringing in as much firepower as they could muster to sway the EXCO members their way. Australia, vying for 2022, had dispatched supermodel Elle Macpherson to Zurich, along with the billionaire chairman of its soccer federation, mall developer Frank Lowy. The rival American delegation included national team star Landon Donovan, actor Morgan Freeman, sitting Attorney General Eric Holder, and former President Bill Clinton. England, the odds-on favorite for 2018, meanwhile, had been humiliated several days earlier by the airing of a BBC documentary accusing three EXCO members of taking millions of dollars in bribes from the sports marketing firm International Sport and Leisure. The report also claimed that Jack Warner, a fourth EXCO member, had attempted to scalp more than $80,000 worth of tickets at the 2010 World Cup. Terrified of the thin-skinned FIFA officials' wrath, England's bid team had tried to get the BBC to delay broadcast of the report, produced by investigative journalist Andrew Jennings. Unsuccessful, the English bid resorted to insults, calling the report unpatriotic and an embarrassment. Despite growing signs that the odds were stacked against it, England had rented two suites at the Bauer Alok and flown in its three lions, Prime Minister David Cameron, Prince William, and David Beckham, to make a final appeal. Then, in a bit of encouraging news for the English, word came that Vladimir Putin would not be coming to Zurich for the vote. The Russian leader noted he was staying away because, he told the press, EXCO members should make their decision in peace and without any outside pressure. For their part, members of England's bid had lurked in the Bauer Alok until well after midnight, buying EXCO members glasses of aged single malt whiskey and desperately attempting to cut last-minute deals to push their effort across the victory line. Before turning in, Jack Warner had effusively embraced Prince William, a sure sign, it seemed, he'd send his vote England's way. Shortly before going to bed in his immaculate residence tucked away on a secluded street in a posh Zurich neighborhood, Blatter received a phone call from President Barack Obama. He had met the president in the Oval Office during a four-day visit the previous year and couldn't help but feel a surge of excitement when he heard his voice on the line. The call, short and formal, lasted only a few minutes. Blatter had publicly expressed support for the U.S. bid on numerous occasions, pointing to the vast commercial opportunities that such an event would provide. Speaking in heavily accented but precise English, he reiterated that posture on the phone, deliberately noting that he had only one vote and could not tell other EXCO members what to do. "How are our chances?" Obama asked. Blatter paused and softly sighed. "Mr. President, it will be difficult." "I understand. Well, good luck," Obama replied before hanging up. They never spoke again. "I am a happy president," said Blatter, looking not particularly happy as he announced that Russia and Qatar had won and would be hosting the World Cup in 2018 and 2022. He stood at the podium before a huge crowd and grimaced. The hundreds of journalists on hand to witness the result of that morning's vote rushed to file accounts of the Russian delegation, including Roman Abramovich, high-fiving and whooping as Blatter handed Deputy Prime Minister Igor Shuvalov the World Cup trophy on stage. Minutes later, Qatar's royal family followed suit, embracing one another, close to tears. Chuck Blazer, in a dark suit and one of his trademark colorful ties, was sitting in the auditorium's front row, which had been reserved for the EXCO. Squeezed between Mohammed bin Hammam of Qatar and Nicolas Leos of Paraguay, he did not join in the cheering, and rose only to briefly embrace the suddenly exultant Qatari beside him, before slumping back into the chair. Directly behind him, Bill Clinton whispered with Sunil Gulati, president of the U.S. Soccer Federation, then rose to shake hands with the politicians and royals in the room. Blazer, America's highest-ranking soccer official, remained motionless, staring stonily ahead. He had voted for Russia rather than England to host the 2018 World Cup, but later admitted he had been shocked when the U.S. did not win the 2022 World Cup. Just a few hours later, Vladimir Putin touched down in Zurich, exultant. At a hastily assembled press conference, he thanked Blatter and insisted that Russia would be ready by 2018, and that he hoped Abramovich, who he said was wallowing in money, would chip in for some of the stadium construction. "Would it be fair to say," one excited journalist fawned, "that you are the cleverest prime minister in the world by staying away and winning the contest from so many thousands of miles away?" "Thank you," Putin said, replying in Russian and smiling. "I'm glad I insisted on giving you the floor. Thank you. It's very nice to hear this." Soccer fans in Australia, Korea, Japan, Spain, Portugal, Belgium, and Holland, all of whom had come up empty-handed, bemoaned the vote and questioned its fairness. Commentators in the press questioned how it could be possible that the two countries least suited to host the World Cup had won, pointing to the inhospitable climatic conditions on Qatar, where daytime temperatures in June and July, when the World Cup was always held, routinely surpassed 115 degrees. Nobody took it harder than England, where the vote dominated headlines for weeks on end, and all conversation on the topic was reduced to agonized soul-searching, finger-pointing, and anguished gnashing of teeth. Despite all its efforts, the country had humiliatingly garnered only two votes, from its own representative on the Exco and from Cameroon's Issa Hayatou, to host the tournament. British Prime Minister David Cameron, who had flown back to London on pressing business earlier that day, first heard the news from an advisor sharing the back seat of his bulletproof Jaguar on the way to Downing Street from Heathrow. The two men slumped in their seats. "We did our best," Cameron finally said, before lapsing into stunned silence. One member of England's bid team cornered Jack Warner and asked him why he had promised his vote, and then voted otherwise. The Trinidadian hissed his reply, "Who was going to stop us?" Another member of that team, riding in a shuttle back to central Zurich from the auditorium, where the results had been announced, noticed FIFA's general secretary, the tall and handsome French lawyer Jérôme Valque, burying his face in his hands, and muttering to himself. "This," Valque kept saying, "is the end of FIFA." The FBI's New York field office occupies seven floors of 26 Federal Plaza, a heavily guarded federal office tower in downtown Manhattan, sandwiched between Chinatown and City Hall. It is the FBI's largest field office, with roughly 1,200 agents. It's about twice the size of the Los Angeles office, and that's not counting the roughly 500 New York Police Department officers assigned to FBI task forces in the building. Sitting in his cubicle on the 23rd floor the morning after the vote, December 3rd, Special Agent Jared Randall lazily flipped through a copy of the New York Times, scanning the day's news. The paper of record had not bothered to dispatch a reporter to Zurich to cover FIFA's vote. The three articles it did carry on FIFA were buried deep inside, starting on page B11 under the headline, "Russia and Qatar Expand Soccer's Global Footprint." The Times' muted reaction fell in line with that of the American public as a whole, which, save for dedicated soccer fans, seemed profoundly uninterested. Even President Obama appeared to take the news in stride, calling the vote the wrong decision, but confidently predicting that the U.S. national team would play well no matter where the World Cup was held. Randall, however, found the articles riveting. He got up and rushed into Mike Gaeta's office, just a few yards from his desk. Lean and athletic with intense dark eyes, Randall was one of the youngest agents in the New York field office. Like a lot of FBI agents, his father was a cop in Narragansett, Rhode Island, where Randall grew up. But he'd shown little interest in law enforcement as a kid. In high school, he'd started a web design business, and he'd majored in computer information systems in college. He considered the FBI only after a recruiter visited campus during his senior year, noting that the Bureau was looking for agents to fight cybercrime. That seemed exciting, and Randall applied at 25, the minimum age allowed. He was assigned to the New York field office straight out of the academy, but never spent a day on cybercrime.
after a few training rotations and a short stint in asset forfeiture, a complex and technical area, Randall was transferred in early 2010 to the Eurasian Crime Squad, C-24. Gaeta was happy to take him. His new squad was pretty thin, and besides, he loved working with young agents.